You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Thank you very much, Sam. And by the way, that was a polite way for Sam to say, I'm speaking in English on behalf of our viewers elsewhere in the world. In actual fact, I suspect if I were to give this presentation in Russian, a lot of the detail might be lost. So I'll apologize for that. I'll also apologize for the fact that because I so recently have joined Carnegie, the visual aspects of this presentation still bear the colors of my previous employer, which are both red and blue. And for those who are familiar with the American political environment, that means both Democrat and Republican, because it was, in fact, a bipartisan organization. And then my third apology, by way of preface, is that, in fact, I am not going to talk specifically about the U.S.-Russia relationship until we get into the discussion, the question and answer. This is more broadly about foreign policy in the United States Congress. And specifically with respect to the tradition of bipartisan Democrat and Republican foreign policy that in the last decade to two decades in the United States has disappeared. Why has that happened? How is it happening? And how can we turn that trend around? So this is really the essence of the data that you will find in the report that I put together and was only published really in the last week. In fact, this is still almost a near final draft that you have. But the data collection is complete. In fact, the printed copy of the report reflects even slightly more updated data than you see in this graphic here, because the very last 2009 data that's available reflects a slight increase in bipartisanship. Just for technical understanding, bipartisanship is measured by a simple equation. It's the number of the number of votes in which a majority of Democrats and a majority of Republicans voted the same way on an issue of national security or foreign policy divided by the number of total votes. Very simple. So it's a percentage. And those percentages are reflected here in this chart. And what you see is that overall, over the past 60 years, it is a distinctly downward trend with many ups and many downs. And we're going to talk about some of those, and we're going to talk about why this is happening. But first, just a word about the Partnership for a Secure America, as Sam said. This is an organization that was founded by Lee Hamilton, who is a very famous and well-respected Democratic American congressman. He chaired the House International Relations Committee. He co-chaired the 9/11 Commission, the Commission on Iraq, and many other bipartisan commissions. And Warren Rudman, who is a Republican senator from New Hampshire, he was a top advisor to John McCain, a close friend of many Republican presidents, and is very well known. The two of these gentlemen came together with a number of their colleagues, all retired from government. It's a very important point. None of them are currently running for political office or otherwise engaged in the political process for their own personal benefit, and therefore they were able to come together. And just for the benefit of those who can't see, these are people like Warren Christopher, Bill Perry, Sam Nunn, Howard Baker, Tony Lake, Bud McFarlane. These are names that should be familiar to anyone who's been involved in the U.S.-Russia relationship any time in the last two decades. So the challenge of doing foreign policy on a bipartisan basis in the United States Congress is certainly a difficult one. As the picture here illustrates, there are many who think it's an impossible challenge. I'm of a different view because I believe that the history and the essence of bipartisan policymaking necessitates that. But let's define our terms before we proceed any farther. What is bipartisanship? First, it is process-oriented. It is about interaction between the political parties. And I describe that as a deliberative interaction, whereby ideas, and that's point two, are aired, that ideas have their own merit. Many ideas are considered regardless of the source. Some people call this nonpartisan. Sam, in fact, I think used that term in his introduction. I would agree with that to an extent, with the qualification that bipartisanship recognizes that the situation in the United States is a two-party political atmosphere. And that there will always be two political parties with competing views in the United States, and that to set about to suggest that there is one right answer that all parties should subscribe to at any given time is perhaps not realistic. Hence, bipartisanship instead of nonpartisanship. Third, bipartisanship is necessary for the policymaking system to function. We'll talk more about why it is actually not only necessary in a moral sense, but in an institutional sense. It's fundamentally built into the system that bipartisan decisions are more effective decisions. And lastly, it is naturally linked with the greatest challenges in national security that the United States has ever faced. And the Cold War is certainly the best example of that. That's something that will be familiar to those of you who recall that Democratic and Republican presidents and Republican and Democratic Congresses were more or less fully engaged in the challenge of the Cold War on the same basis. And just to suggest a few of the major overarching national challenges the United States faces today, so that we don't think that because the Cold War has ended, the need for bipartisanship in foreign policy has disappeared. Another important warning or caveat is from one of my colleagues in Washington who said that even the best bipartisan deliberation does not guarantee sound policy, and the absence of bipartisanship doesn't prevent it. So, bipartisanship is, generally speaking, necessary but not sufficient for good foreign policy. Another caveat is that political parties are important. I'm not arguing against the role of politics in national security. I'm arguing against the role of partisanship, and these are two different concepts. The reason political parties are important is simple. Political parties help to take many people, aggregate their views, aggregate their knowledge into something that's digestible and understandable. Through debates, which come about generally in the context of political parties and party competition, they help to clarify issues. Where do we agree and where do we disagree? That's very important. Through party platforms, in other words, the sets of positions that political parties represent on a broad range of issues, they help average people who don't think about every issue, if they even think about one issue, to feel more engaged in the political process. They can say, I'm generally speaking a Democrat, I'm generally speaking a Republican, and so I know generally that I support the following positions. Lastly, they're important. You have there a picture, I think, of the coronation. Actually, I'm not sure who that is. But you have generally the opportunity through political party competition for new blood to enter the system, as opposed to in a monarchy or an autocratic system where generally there's one dominant political entity and they bring up new people, if at all, through a process that sort of limits their thinking. So it's helpful to have two parties in that respect as well. But, of course, the process has been taken to an extreme, as illustrated by my Three Stooges picture. So why is bipartisanship necessary? Obviously, if we're pushing in opposite directions, we don't go anywhere. First reason that bipartisanship is necessary for the American political system is that that system, unlike our judicial system, does not depend on what's called zealous advocacy, the idea that if a person on one side pushes as hard as they possibly can for their position, and a person on the other side pushes in the opposite direction, a neutral judge or a neutral jury will decide what the truth is. We don't have that in the legislative branch. In the legislative branch, you only have the two parties, which means at the end of the day, no matter how hard each of the two parties push, they have to come together in order for anything to happen. And so unlike a courtroom where the two sides can walk out the door having completely destroyed any relationship they had with each other, we cannot afford to do that in the legislative branch of government. Another reason is because Democrats and Republicans bring different skills to the table. Democrats have experience that Republicans don't have and vice versa. And when it comes to foreign policy, where most members of Congress don't know very much at all, it's critical that we pool and collect all the knowledge that we have. So thinking what I call with both halves of our brain. Second, the problem of swing votes. When political parties reliably only vote in one direction all the time, that means that the one or two members in the middle who are willing to swing back and forth basically decide all of the questions. And we've seen an illustration of that very recently in the United States Senate, where one or two senators were able to sit down with the party leaders on both sides and basically have an auction for who could buy them. And lastly, because in order to implement foreign policy programs, you need money. And in order to have sustainable funding for the long term, when control of Congress will change between Democrats and Republicans, you need to have both sides signed up for the same program. Otherwise, as soon as control of Congress changes, the money will disappear. This is just a sort of an illustration of the importance of one more point, which is continuity. In a relationship like the U.S.-Russia relationship or the U.S.-Soviet relationship, it was important that American administrations and American Congresses be perceived as fully engaged throughout the duration of that relationship of 50 years or more. Otherwise, both sides might lose confidence in the purpose of the relationship, or one side might try to take advantage of changes in political power on the other side. That was very important during the Cold War. And then lastly, perhaps most importantly, there are some things that you just can't achieve without bipartisan support. Those are usually things that are in the long-term interests of the country, but in the short term don't appear so. So, for example, free trade. Signing a free trade agreement with a foreign country is one of the most difficult things that an American president can do, because it seems in the short term that it will cost jobs, particularly in some states in the United States. And without bipartisan agreement to provide the political sort of safety zone or cover, that would never be possible. There's kind of a new, what I would call conventional wisdom, or a sort of popular criticism of bipartisanship in Washington, which is that it's a waste of time because it doesn't work. Well, I would agree that it hasn't been working lately, but I wouldn't agree it's a waste of time, and I would just point out that a lot of the biggest critics of bipartisanship, if you look at why they're criticizing, it's because they are personally interested in more partisan politics, and I'll talk more about who and why that is. So just a word about the history of the role of bipartisanship in U.S. foreign policy. It's something that's been supported by many deeply respected foreign policy thinkers from the 1950s to the present day. Senator Arthur Vandenberg, who together with Harry Truman introduced NATO, the Marshall Plan, the United Nations, many of the basic ideas they supported on a bipartisan basis. Henry Kissinger, John F. Kennedy, Chuck Hagel, Lee Hamilton, Dick Lugar have all come out strongly in support of bipartisanship. So there's a strong tradition among the most respected foreign policy thinkers in America. In fact, very recently, President Obama sat down with a group of four leading national security experts, two Democrats, two Republicans, Sam Nunn, George Shultz are pictured here, Henry Kissinger, and Bill Perry as well. And after coming out of that meeting, President Obama specifically talked about the long tradition of bipartisan foreign policy that has been a hallmark of America at moments of greatest need. However, it wasn't always the case. One famous example is when President Wilson brought an American delegation to the Versailles Peace Conference, at which the American idea for a League of Nations was discussed. He failed to bring any Republicans with him. Now, that would have been one thing had the Republicans been in the minority at the time, as they are today in the Congress. But actually, at that time, the Republicans had just won a large victory and became the majority in the Congress, which is an illustration of the importance of continuity over time. So by failing to take any Republicans, he made enemies with an important senator, among others, Senator La Follette of Wisconsin, who described the president as being cocksure and stubborn, as well as inexperienced and ignorant of more than the merest smattering of problems. And of course, he accused the president of being intensely partisan, making him almost impossible to work with. So it's rhetoric that we're used to hearing today in Washington. It's interesting that this was almost 100 years ago, and the result of this, as we all know, was that the United States did not join the League of Nations, and we had World War II. Other famous failures, Teddy Roosevelt, in trying to reform the tariff system, despite being a relatively liberal or progressive Republican, failed to engage with progressive Democrats, and so he had bipartisan opposition to his tariff reform. President Carter, in his pursuance of arms control, had absolutely almost no Republican support, meaning that most of the deliverables occurred subsequently in the Reagan administration. I love the example of Vietnam. This is the same exact war being pursued by a Democratic president and then a Republican president. And yet when it was being pursued by a Democratic president, through ineptitude on his part primarily. He was being attacked by Republicans, and vice versa. President Nixon was almost exclusively attacked by Democrats. President Clinton, I think a famous case would be the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. Not a single Republican voted for that treaty. Again, it was President Clinton's failure to reach out effectively to Republicans. President Bush, many, many examples. Certainly the Iraq War provides the best and a relatively recent one of those. A famous success, probably the most famous, was during World War II when President Roosevelt, who had just defeated Wendell Willkie, his Republican opponent, actually reached out to Willkie and made him his emissary to the rest of the world to try to drum up support for the Great War for Democracy. But other famous successes include, as I mentioned, cooperation between President Truman and Republican senators. President Carter worked with both the Democratic and Republican leaders. The Nunn-Lugar program is a great example. The achievements of that program are well known to people here in Russia as well as at home. And then President Reagan, this is amazing, worked with Tip O'Neill, the Speaker of the U.S. House, who was probably one of the most liberal Democrats, and Reagan was among the most conservative Republican presidents. But those two had a famously productive relationship. The downside of bipartisanship is interesting, which is that for a period of about 30 years, while there was consensus on foreign policy, the same consensus dominated in domestic policy in a very negative way, which was that there was essentially no movement on civil rights or other domestic civil liberties, and so the Southern segregationists were able to sort of make a deal where they got they supported Republicans on foreign policy, but instead maintained segregation at home. So there are downsides. Recently, if you look at voting in the American Congress, you find that the votes are kind of all over the place. You know, for Afghanistan, we had a 98-0 vote in favor, so bipartisan. The Iraq invasion vote was not quite as bipartisan, but still the Patriot Act, which was the package of reforms that were passed after September 11th, also bipartisan. And then yet, almost everything that President Obama has done has been received on a totally partisan basis. So his first budget was a purely partisan vote with no Republican support. The health care reform bill, no Republican support. All right, so why has all of this happened? Let's just talk about some of the fundamental causes. Many Americans would argue that, well, our country as a whole is just more partisan. If you look at the numbers, that appears to be true, at least on some issues. More Republicans support capital punishment, more Democrats oppose it. More Republicans oppose gay marriage, more Democrats oppose it, or support it, excuse me. Global warming, stem cell research, all of these sort of social issues in America, we're very divided. Similarly, it's interesting to note that the gap, and that's the number on the far right, the gap between Democrats' approval of a president and Republican approval of a president has grown consistently from Nixon, which the gap was less than 30 points. As controversial a figure as Nixon was, there was only a difference of 30 points in Democrat-Republican approval. Today, that has more than doubled, with Republicans hating Obama and Democrats loving him. So it would seem like we're a much more polarized country. If you ask the average person whether we are more polarized, they generally agree. Majority of people say that Democrats and Republicans have been bickering more than ever this year, and the country is more politically divided than ever. That has been consistently true for the last 5 years. Everybody thinks America is more divided. But interestingly, if you look at foreign policy, that's not the case. If you look at a list of top American national security and foreign policy priorities, almost the same numbers of Democrats and Republicans agree about those priorities. America's standing in the world, preventing WMD, weapon of mass destruction, spreading, protecting against terrorism, reducing energy dependence, the challenge from China, from North Korea, from Pakistan, from Iran. Across the board, Democrats and Republicans agree at least that these are top priorities, and we can talk about the details in terms of their disagreements about how we approach them. So why is this happening? I think the first reason is you have to look at who members of Congress are and how they get there. Members of the House are elected from political districts, which are subsets of individual states. You can see on the board maps of some of these political districts. There's absolutely no logic to these maps in a geographic sense. The logic is purely political. They are designed, the term is gerrymandered, they are designed to support a Democratic candidate or a Republican candidate. Well, the result of that, when that happens, is that the general election doesn't matter, because if there are 80% Democrats in a given political district, then the Democrat will always win. The Republican will never have a chance. What matters is the primary election, the election to pick who the Democratic candidate will be. And when that's the case, usually the candidate is pushed farther to the left or farther to the right, because the people who vote in the primary election are only people who are party members, and they are more to the left or more to the right. So gerrymandering of political districts is the first problem. The second problem is the influence of money in politics. In 1976, it cost roughly $600,000 to win a seat in the United States Senate. In 2000, it cost $7.2 million. Those are in today's dollars. That's accounting for inflation. In 1974, it cost under $100,000 to beat an incumbent in the United States House. In 2002, it cost over $1.5 million, again, adjusted for inflation. So the fact is, what members of Congress are forced to do, first of all, is constantly be chasing money, which means they're not working on their jobs, they're not spending time with one another, they're definitely not wasting time with someone who might be their opponent. They're spending time with people who are going to support their cause, who are people on their team. Also, just a quick point about our campaign finance reform laws, which you may have heard about. Unfortunately, the result of campaign finance reform has in some ways been the exact opposite of what it was supposed to be. By limiting the dollar amount that each individual can give to $2,500, which is a pretty small amount of money, what that means is that in order to receive enough money for a campaign, a candidate needs to bundle together lots and lots of small donations into a big donation. Well, who has the ability to do that? Political parties. So this has made the role of political parties and political organizations much, much more important for candidates who can no longer go to wealthy individuals or institutions to solicit contributions. All right, there are also some very important causes that have to do with the way life in Congress functions. And for any of you who have ever had any interaction with Congress, this should be obvious. Congress doesn't work a full week. We work Monday through Friday, most of the world. Sometimes an additional weekend day. Congress works Tuesday through Thursday. And that is so that members of Congress can fly home to where they're from on Friday and stay through Monday, because they have to raise money, and they have to be on television, and they have to go to parades. That's a new factor. 50 years ago, 100 years ago, members of Congress lived in Washington until the summertime, and in the summertime they went home. But when they lived in Washington, they lived together, they knew each other, their children played together, they went to the same schools. So Democrats and Republicans were forced to socialize. There's a hugely increased workload on Capitol Hill. Just to give an example, the health care bill was over 10,000 pages long. No one in Congress read that bill, but the simple fact of having to put that together requires tons of staff, tons of meetings. It's a workload that no one can handle, and it doesn't leave time for anything else. Members of Congress have more assignments to committees today than they used to, which means they're expected to be in more places. They have more meeting requests from lobbyists and from voters back home, and that's simply because those people can fly to Washington much more easily, and there are more lobbyists. They spend more time with the media because we have more television channels, and more of them are 24-hour television channels. And lastly, this is kind of an interesting wrinkle. It used to be, because of technology, again, that members of Congress had to go to the floor of the House, in other words, to the actual chamber, and wait around for their name to be called in order to vote. That's no longer the case. Now they vote with an electronic card, which means they walk to the floor with five or six of their retinue around them, conducting another meeting or an interview while they're doing it. They stick their card in, they press a button, and they leave. So they actually don't interact with other members, with their colleagues, only with their staff and with the media and folks who come to see them. This is just an example of a committee hearing room. I want to emphasize this point. Notice lots of experts lined up like we are here to answer questions so that members of Congress can learn, and nobody's watching. This is a typical committee hearing in Congress today. Subcommittees, it's especially bad. Usually you'll have one person sitting there. It's usually the chairman of the committee, but he or she will often leave after 5 or 10 minutes, be replaced by maybe one other member. So the reality is, members of Congress are not really spending any time in the committees that they're assigned to anyway, so you ask, why should we have these in the first place? This speaks to the larger paradox, which is that in American business, and I think in business internationally, a lot of deals are done on the golf course. In other words, it's through social interaction, having a drink together, getting to know each other, having a meal. That's where business is done. And we elect members of Congress to go to Washington to do business. But because of the demands that we put on their schedules, because of the demands put on them by the media, by lobbyists and special interests, they don't actually have time to do these things. They don't get to know each other, and they're not getting business done. Just a couple of quotes. I like this one. Senator Rudman, who is my former boss, says that all my friends are back home in New Hampshire. I don't have any friends in Washington. So, as I said, no friends. All right. A few more important structural causes. Discipline by party leaders. This is very important. Two ways in which party leaders can exercise discipline. One is the calendar. If there's somebody important that you want appointed to be a judge or to be an ambassador because he's a friend of yours, because he's from your home state, because he's someone who donated to your campaign, you better be good friends with the party leadership because they're the ones who schedule that vote. And if they don't like you, they're not going to schedule the vote. The second way, of course, is that party leaders are usually some of the safest elected officials, which means they don't have to spend a lot on their own re-election campaigns because why would the folks back home vote them out of power when they're some of the most influential people in Washington? There is an exception to that right now, which is Harry Reid, the Democratic leader from Nevada, is in some trouble. But that means that party leaders have a lot of money at their disposal from their own campaign war chests and from the party, and they can hand out that money. And there's no limit on the money that the party can spend on behalf of an individual candidate. So that gives them a lot of ability to influence candidates. Second is the end of seniority. The so-called Watergate babies. These were the members of Congress elected in 1975 after the Watergate scandal. They ended seniority for committee chairmen, which means the committee chairmen are generally now younger and weaker than they used to be, and they cannot stand up to the party leaders. The Republican Revolution in 1994 completed that trend. Newt Gingrich was famous in the 1980s for speaking out against Tip O'Neill, who was, as I mentioned, an ally of President Reagan and the Speaker of the House. And he was primed when he came into leadership to strengthen the role of the central party leaders in Congress. I provide a picture here of a coach and a basketball team. This happens to be the Duke basketball team because they're very famous for being greater than the sum of their parts. The idea is you take individual players, and instead of playing as individuals, they play as a team, and it makes them stronger. That might make sense for government, but it certainly doesn't make sense for politics. In politics, you want individual voices, people who are willing to speak out for unpopular positions because they're elected by the people to do so. That doesn't happen in American politics. Another important factor is the increasing role of outsiders. They often describe Congress and American politics as the ultimate insiders club. But the reality is outsiders have tremendous influence. At the bottom of the screen, you see a picture of grassroots. Grassroots is a sort of key term to describe the role of voters in politics, except it's not voters. What it is the organizations who can organize and represent voters. And here there are some pictures of some famous liberal activist groups. But it's not just liberal activist groups. In the 1960s, you had the creation of many liberal groups, which brought elite young Americans from the Ivy League and with great educations to Washington to lobby on behalf of these causes. But of course, there were conservative responses to these as well. So now what we have is we have a professional class of political advocates who are not in government. That means they don't bear a responsibility to get anything done. They are responsible to the political constituency that employs them, that pays them to work. And unfortunately, we've even had this happen in the think tank world. With no disrespect meant to my colleague Sam, who was here last week, the Center for American Progress is a Democratic Party think tank. The Heritage Foundation is a Republican Party think tank. I like to think that the Carnegie Endowment is in the middle, that we're a nonpartisan think tank, that we're bipartisan. I think we are. But the fact that this is even an issue in Washington today is an indication of how far we've come down this very dangerous road. And I would just say that the notion that partisan conflict has been institutionalized in the big famous think tanks and other organizations in Washington is good for those who want to have job security because they know they can go through the revolving door from a Democratic Party institution to a Democratic congressman to a Democratic administration and back out to a Democratic institution. But it's not good for the system overall, and I'm not picking on Democrats. It's true of Republicans as well. We also have sort of a media phenomenon going on. On the right, you see an advertisement that ran in the New York Times. This is a play on words, General Petraeus or General Betray Us, which was an attack on the commanding general in Iraq by a liberal group called MoveOn.org. whose mission is to bring new donors into the Democratic Party and to hurt Republicans. And below that, you have a picture of, of Rush Limbaugh, whose mission in life is to find and discredit Democrats. And he did that very well with President Clinton. That's why he's holding a cigar in this picture. He's an interesting character. But the point is, essentially, we have declining Congress, declining contact between officials in the executive administration and Congress. President Obama has turned that around a little bit. And at the same time, we have increasing contact between the media and the political class. And these two things are pulling in different directions. There are two networks in the United States that are famous now for being partisan. Fox News is sort of a Republican outlet. MSNBC is generally considered a more Democratic outlet. And these two gentlemen on the right, even though they're sort of portrayed as news anchors, like Walter Cronkite, sort of a trusted nonpartisan source, these two guys have actually made their careers by fighting with each other on the TV airwaves. And as I mentioned, the 24-hour news has sort of increased the pressure for politicians to spend more time with these people. The more time they spend with them, the more they have to pick sides, the more they have to cater to this problem. So finally, a slightly more sociological or psychological explanation for what's going on is that it's basically just easier for the human brain to deal with partisanship. So-called System 1 reactions or Stone Age brain reactions are very intuitive, fast. Is this a threat to me? What do I need to do to respond and keep myself safe? System 2 reactions take much more time to think about the evidence, the pluses and the minuses, and to make a judgment. Politicians don't have time. They rely on System 1 reactions. Second, the so-called rule of typical things. A single example proves the rule. We have a lot of very polarizing examples in American politics today. Dick Cheney, Nancy Pelosi are considered sort of extremes, but they are not, in fact, the majority. But they are perceived to be the majority because their images and their words are constantly repeated, and so it becomes the rule for how Americans think about politics. Two more factors, confirmation bias. You come in knowing what you believe, and so the evidence you hear confirms what you already believe. And lastly, the herd mentality. If you watch political theater, which is political conventions, so when you have the presidential campaigns, you have big gatherings of people, it's a great example of herd mentality. No one would want to stand up and oppose the herd. Everyone wants to go with the flow. I mentioned some reasons how the party leaders discipline anyone who doesn't do that. That wasn't always true. 100 years ago, American political conventions were debate societies. People would come to the convention to debate who the nominee should be. Today, that's not true. Everybody comes. Everybody knows who the nominee should be. So what do we do to fix this problem? Just quickly, President Obama has set a very positive tone with leadership. He's kept more than a handful of Republicans or appointed new ones. Bob Gates was Republican appointee. Jim Jones advised John McCain. Ray LaHood is his Secretary of Transportation. He was a Republican congressman. John McCune is the Secretary of the Army, also a Republican congressman. The picture on the bottom left is a picture of President Obama hosting a Super Bowl party for Democrat and Republican members of Congress and actually going around and serving appetizers. You know what? It's a great strategy if you want to make friends. So what else can the president do? Bipartisan cabinet appointments, very important. Bipartisan working groups bring together experts from both sides, people who formerly served in government, people like the board of the organization where I used to serve, and ask them what they think about issues, and do it repeatedly. That's the key. Build relationships. Also, consult regularly with leaders of both parties of Congress. So don't just wait until there's a crisis and then call everyone together and see if they agree. Bring them together on a regular basis, biweekly, monthly, etc. And also meet with former party leaders. Because like I said about the board of PSA, my organization, these folks have less to lose. And if they have less invested in the current political climate, then they're going to be more willing to make compromises. So it's a two-way street, though, which means Congress has to do some things as well. It would make a lot of sense to get outside the committee structure and just have so-called caucus meetings. Caucuses are informal groups of people who are interested in a subject. And in fact, there was recently a Russia caucus created by a Republican member of Congress and a Democratic member of Congress. I'd be happy to comment on that. But also to deal specifically with the problem of committees, reduce the number of committees that members sit on so that they can actually sit in committees, get to know their fellow committee members, making Senate appointments faster so that individual senators cannot put a hold on an appointment and certainly cannot do so secretly. Congressional delegations, CODELs, these are trips abroad for members of Congress. They're very important because when members of Congress go abroad, not only do they learn about the world around them, which supposedly they're making decisions about, but they also spend time with each other in an environment where there's less press following them around, there are less pressures, they don't have voters coming to see them, knocking on their door. So it's a good way for them to bond and get to know each other. I know that Senator Margulov recently led a delegation to Washington. I'm sure that the result there for him was very good in terms of the time that he spent not only with Americans but with his own colleagues. The so-called filibuster majority is 60 votes out of 100 in the Senate. I think if you look at the numbers in the Senate today, 60 votes is too close to the dividing line between the Democratic number and the Republican number. The Democrats have roughly 58, 59 votes. The Republicans have 40. So that means that all you need to do is win one or two votes to win on any issue. So if you move that up to two-thirds, 67, then you would have to win 8 or 10 people. And that means you're more likely to have relationships with more people. So I think that would be an effective reform. And lastly, committee chairs need to request that every question end with a question mark. No speeches, and that members have to sit and listen. Structural reforms, like I mentioned, the gerrymandering of political districts needs to end. The state of Iowa is a good example. They have 5 congressional seats. 3 are held by Democrats. 2 are held by Republicans. They are always competitive, and the reason for that is they follow these square grids. They follow the county lines instead of drawing political districts according to population politics and letting the state legislators do it. I'm going to skip through some of these specific reforms. Just a note about an interesting program that my old organization is running. We bring about 30 congressional staff. These are the people who actually know the issues, Democrats and Republicans. We bring them together. We do simulated national security crises with them, so the issue of piracy off of Somalia, U.S.-Russia relations, et cetera. And we also take them out on retreats. We take them out to the woods. They go rafting together. They get to know each other. And then they go to the White House. There they're meeting with some national security staff. So they do all kinds of things together, but the result is they get to know each other. That's what we care about. They can work together. And then the last thing is, of course, studying these issues and being informed, and I would welcome any questions that you all might have about the information that's in here. So thank you.